Hello, I'm Terrence McNally. Welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'm going to be speaking today with Kevin Boyle. He's a National Book Award winner, a professor of American history at Northwestern University. And we're going to talk about his latest book, The Shattering America in the 60s, in the 1960s. And you can learn more at kevinboylehistory.com. That's all one word, Kevin Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E, history.com. On Free Forum, we explore the lives and the work and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at politics, economics, environment, science, health, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on kpfk.org Thursdays at 4 p.m. Pacific. Streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on tunein.com. Podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Podomatic.com, most major podcast sites, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. No surprise to regular listeners, I have a keen interest in the 1960s. They formed, to a great extent, the crucible in which my identity, my worldview, and my political outlook was forged. I was 12 years old in 1960 when John Kennedy was elected president. I was at my desk in Mrs. Cunningham's 7th period algebra class when word of his assassination came over the loudspeaker. I graduated in 1965 from Cocoa High, about 20 miles from Cape Canaveral, just as the Apollo program was in full gear. I entered Harvard in the fall sporting a flat top, graduated in 1969 with hair to my shoulders, though I cut it way back a couple of months later to attend my draft physical in Jacksonville, Florida. And while in college, I jettisoned my virginity, sampled psychedelics, founded an alternative high school, won one of the college's highest academic awards, and was awakened at dawn in University Hall when Massachusetts state troopers cleared the building of protesters. In the first few years of the 1970s, those that many include in the long 60s, for 6 months, I was part of a sailing commune, though I disembarked before they left the Atlantic, spent a full season tending an organic farm, lived out of my van traveling in the U.S. and Mexico, and ran a Los Angeles assembly district for the McGovern presidential campaign. As I have stated before on this show, many of us who took part in the movements of the 1960s and 70s felt that we were going to revolutionize America. We aimed to bring about racial and economic justice, end U.S. imperialism, reinvent education, unite the working class, and liberate women and gays. 50 years later, inequality is worse, racial justice has stalled, we face a potentially existential climate crisis, and democracy may be under even greater threat. Much has been written about America in the 1960s, and I've recently spoken with siblings David and Margaret Talbot about their 2021 book, By the Light of Burning Dreams, The Triumphs and Tragedies of the Second American Revolution, and with Edward P. Morgan about his 2010 book, What Really Happened to the 1960s, How Mass Media Culture Failed American Democracy. Both conversations are available at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net, and at most major podcast sites. And I've been eager to talk with today's guest, Kevin Boyle. His new book, The Shattering, America in the 1960s, threads a path through this history that does a good job at avoiding the traps of redundancy on the one hand and gimmicky contrarianism on the other. There are a number of ways that Boyle brings fresh eyes and perspectives to bear, and I'll leave him to expand on those during our conversation, but allow me to point out a few things he does. He focuses on three big issues: American militarism, racial relations, and the sexual revolution. In appreciating their resonance in today's culture and politics, think Afghanistan, Black Lives Matter, white supremacy, Roe v. Wade, he takes the long view, excavating the sources of both 60s uprisings and the reactionary responses to them in America's experience of the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. And though he devotes much attention to the usual politicians and activists, the big names, he focuses also on lesser-known individuals to flesh out his story. Kevin Boyle is the William Smith Mason Professor of American History at Northwestern University. His previous book, Arc of Justice, won the National Book Award for Nonfiction, and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He's also the author of The UAW and the Heyday of American Liberalism, 1948-68, and co-author of Muddy Boots and Ragged Aprons. His essays and reviews appear in newspapers and magazines, including The Washington Post and The New York Times. Welcome, Kevin Boyle, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work.
Thanks so much for having me, Terrence. I really appreciate it.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, June 14th. Now, Kevin, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. So can you tell us a bit about how you see your path to the work you do today? And feel free to go way back, childhood inspirations, mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Sure. So I am technically, I suppose, a child of the 1960s. I was born in October of 1960. But my memories of the 1960s are a child's memories. They're the fragments of the experience of most Americans who lived through the 1960s. I was born and raised in Detroit. And what that has meant to me is that I came of age in the 1960s and the 1970s in a world fiercely divided by race. And that has become a driving force in the work that I've done over the course of my career to write about the American racial experience, the American racial dilemma. And that's one of the major themes of the book. I also grew up, I was from kind of lower middle class family. I grew up in a neighborhood that was right on the brink between the upper end of the working class and the lower end of the middle class, completely white neighborhood. And I think that experience as well shaped my sense of the world that I ended up writing about in The Shattering. And then I've been teaching a course on the 1960s, or I had been teaching a course in the 1960s for many years to students who, of course, were born long after the 1960s, which leads me to try to think about the ways in which that world of the 1960s continues to have resonance for young people.
Okay. Let me ask a quick question, and then I'm going to turn to what you just said. Any response to my introduction, in which I sort of wove a little bit of my path?
Yeah, your path is an absolutely fascinating one and a really compelling one, and it's a crucial piece of the 1960s. It's really quite a remarkable piece of the 1960s, I have to say.
Yeah, whenever I kind of recount that, I feel a little like Zelig, you know?
Yeah, I think you've got a fair call there, actually. I think what, for me, is kind of a critical piece of the story I'm trying to tell is I'm trying to tell the story of people like you who are deeply engaged in the social movements of the 1960s. And as you said, I talk about the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement. I talk about the anti-war movements, and I believe that there were multiple anti-war movements. I talk a little bit about the gay rights movement. I talk quite a bit about the drive to transform the relationship between the state and people's privacy, and particularly their sexuality. And I think those are fundamentally important stories. Wouldn't have told them if I didn't think they were fundamentally important stories. I think they have transformative stories, but I also want to place them within a kind of bigger America. One of the statistics that really struck me when I was working on the book is that in the course of the 1960s, fewer than 10% of Americans ever participated in a protest of any kind in the entire 1960s. More people participated as a percentage of the population in the George Floyd protest in the summer of 2020 than participated in any protest in the 1960s. And so what I wanted to do was take experiences like yours, the movements that you were a pivotal part of, and place them within this bigger framework of that 90% of Americans who didn't participate. And that's what I tried to do with the book in the way that I framed it around a single family who had nothing to do with the protests of the 1960s. Because what gets shattered in the 1960s is there is portions of their world. And it's in that shattering that then we get to the end of the 1960s, a nation that has certainly been fundamentally changed, there's no doubt about that, but that also has managed to contain some of the dramatic movements of the 1960s.
I often ask why this book at this moment, and of course we know how long it takes to write a book, so this moment, maybe the moment of publication or a few months after that, but we know that it means that something was percolating in your mind and your spirit 2 to 3, you know, I'm just ballparking there, years ago. What was it, and can you connect it to your experience of teaching about the 60s to young people?
Yeah, I think that one of the most important things about the 1960s, the reason that it's important to teach about the 1960s, and I like to think to write about the 1960s, is the way that it still has these profound resonances in the world that those young people are in the process of inheriting.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been striking to me how much resonance the 1960s has in our current moment. So as you said, you very kindly explained, the book has kind of three main stories it follows. And one of those stories is the struggle for racial justice. Well, clearly, we are not at the end of the struggle for racial justice in the United States. And I think the events of the last 2 years have a real resonance for the 1960s, both in the explosion of protest that I just mentioned, especially in the summer of 2020, but also in the backlash against mm-hmm. that protest. And that's what we're seeing now. I think that the story of Vietnam is a story so much tied to the question of the United States' place in the world and the United States' role in the world more broadly. And when I watched what happened in Afghanistan, another process of nation building, just the summer before this, that had so many resonances of Vietnam. And of course, your listeners certainly don't need me to say that Roe v. Wade is at the center of American politics and in American public life. And in the next few weeks, will become even more in the center of American public life. The story of Roe is one of the stories that I bring to the end of my book, because it's one of those fundamental shatterings.
Mm-hmm. Very, very good. And I want to talk a little bit about your approach, which we've both been talking about to some extent, which is that you look at the big picture and the big headlines, but you also focus on individuals behind the scenes. I actually was reminded of Howard Zinn's A People's History, in that he was sort of singular for a while in writing about history in terms of lesser known individuals, although most of his were in some sense activists, whereas you actually are also talking about folks who were not activists, who were just part of the larger context in which activists and reactionaries had their battles. But in terms of your approach, you actually started one talk I saw of yours by quoting Joan Didion. And she's someone else who's been in the news because of her passing. And I'm just going to read the quote that you read and then let you reflect on that. It's from White Album, and it's one of her most famous quotes. We tell ourselves stories in order to live. Entirely by the imposition of a narrative line for the images and ideas with which we have learned to freeze the shifting phantasmagoria, which is our actual experience, or at least do so for a while. You have said the shattering is your attempt to take the phantasmagoria of the 1960s and reshape them into a new story. Talk a bit about your method.
Yeah, you can boil my method down to a really quick phrase. I love a good story. I think that one of the keys to teaching history, one of the keys, I think, to connecting with students, I hope to connecting with readers, at least in my experience, has been connecting with readers, that what people want to see is a story. They want to see character. They want to see action. They want to see the development of events. Now, it's my job as a historian to render those events as honestly and as completely and as thoroughly as I can. I don't get to make it up. My writing would be a lot easier if I got to make it up, but I don't. But I do believe that our responsibility as historians, our job as historians, is to take this enormous complexity of the past, and in this case, to take the story of an entire nation, a massive nation of people, and try to give it some order, to try to give it a narrative, to try to give it a line that people can follow and that is true to the past. And then you can hang all sorts of analyses on that storyline, but people want and need, and I love, a good storyline. It's also fundamentally important to me, and I can't tell you how pleased I am that you mentioned Howard Zinn. It's fundamentally important to me to understand, to try to get across to people that history is made by powerful people. It is. There's no denying that. The President of the United States, for good or ill, has enormous power. The justices of the Supreme Court have enormous power, and they're part of the story, and I think you have to tell them they're part of the story. It's also made by activists, some well-known. I talk about Martin Luther King. It would be a crazy book about the 1960s to not talk about Martin Luther King. But I think King is fundamentally important, but so is Ella Baker.
Mm-hmm.
And Ella Baker is a figure who doesn't get the sort of central place that she deserved. And then there are those ordinary people who are caught up in the moments of protest. And I talk about a number of them. I talk about Elizabeth Eckford, the young woman who in 1957 walks into a mob in front of Little Rock High School, or Norma McCorvey, the Roe of Roe v. Wade. And then there are the people who really don't feature in many histories of the 1960s, mm-hmm. who are those utterly ordinary people who weren't activists, who were never at a protest, who weren't engaged in the transformative movements, who had no power on the level of a president or even a block captain for that matter, just completely ordinary people. And I believe history runs through them too. But history, that story is their story too. And that's really been fundamental to my sense of how I want to tell history.
Very, very good.
Why I love Joan Didion's quote.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Another thing that seems to have prompted this book, this is a quote I really tickled me, and I want you to expand on it, which is, how are we to understand the 60s now that so much history has changed?
Yeah. Yeah.
And to most people, history is history, and yet to you, a historian, history of a time which was fairly recent has changed in the 50 years or so since.
Yeah, I'm so happy that you brought up that quote. What I was trying to say in that passage, in that sentence, is really two things. There is the history that my fellow historians write. And there is a ton of that history of various aspects of the 1960s, brilliant history. And over that 50 years since the 1960s, a lot of that history that my fellow historians write has changed. People have emphasized new things, emphasized aspects of the 1960s that weren't emphasized, say, 40 years ago. So that's one side of the story. And then there's the side, the kind of the other way to read that is so many events, so many dynamics have changed in that 50 years. It would have been unimaginable in 1968, to imagine that a black man would ever be president mm-hmm. of the United States in the lifetimes of, say, a young person in the 1960s. It would have been an unimaginable thought. On the other hand, when we have the events that we have seen in recent years, the January 6th insurrection, the rise of the white supremacist, the mainstreaming of white supremacist mm-hmm. organizations. That's a dramatically different turn than the 1960s, though you can see its roots.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what I want to do is I want to link up those roots, not in a really explicit way. I think readers, I have great respect for readers. Mm-hmm. They'll draw the connections that they want to draw and that they're valuable to draw. But I think it's important as an historian in telling that story to say, you can see the roots of what we are living through in the 1960s. When I was writing the chapter on 1968,
mm-hmm.
and I opened that chapter by describing George Wallace.
Yep, that's where I was going
to
go.
to Chicago for a campaign stops, September of 1968. And he did the thing that everybody did when he did campaign stops in those days. You came in to downtown and you did drive down State Street, down the main street of downtown Chicago, the great shopping street in downtown Chicago, so the crowds could come out and see you in the back of the car. And then he did something else. Then he took a side trip out to the working class white, then working class suburb of Cicero. And he held a rally in the streets of Cicero. And Teddy White, the famous political journalist, was on the campaign that day. He went out with them. And Teddy White has this really vivid description of this outdoor rally in working class white Cicero in September of 68. And as he's describing it, what you hear is a Trump rally.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's the roots. That's where you see the roots of our present day, when so much history has changed. But you can see the roots in the 1960s in a way that I think an earlier generation of books on the 1960s didn't trace to the depth that I think we need to.
That's exactly where I was going to go, Kevin. The Wallace Rally, the Wallace Motorcade that drew 50,000 people, only a few blocks from where only weeks earlier the police violence against the protesters at the Democratic Convention had happened. People remember the Democratic Convention and the violence. Academy Award nominated movie just the past year about the Chicago conspiracy trial. But people don't talk much, really, surprisingly, about the Wallace phenomenon, the Wallace campaign. Yeah. And you could do one of those computer morphing things, right? Of Wallace to Trump, and it would change very little in terms of what they were saying. Let me ask a big sort of question. And I know this, in a way, is a false choice, and I'm going to ask it two different ways. One is about the book's title, The Shattering. And for the sake of argument, is The Shattering a positive or a negative shattering? And my guess is it depends whose life is being shattered. And then also another way of asking a sort of the similar question is, which side of the story, the progressive upheavals or the reactionary responses, had the greater or more lasting influence? Or is it a draw? Or is it an ongoing battle? And are we just in extra innings? Kind of take on those two.
Those are great questions. I think I'm going to take the first question in a slightly different way. The Shatterer, I like this title a lot. But I think that a more accurate title, which is not as good a title, and wouldn't have sold, doesn't jump off the desk, is The Partial Shattering.
Oh, yeah.
That what happened in the 1960s was that the social movements of the 1960s, left and right, actually, pushed up against a political and economic order that had been built really in the 1950s, a kind of middle class white order of prosperity and security. And it pushed up against those, partly in order for those who had been left out of that order to be able to claim a place in it. That's part of the story of civil rights in the United States. Partly against the injustices of that order, and partly against the excesses of that order. And when I say that, what I'm really thinking about is that that political order rested very much on the enormous power of the military-industrial complex. And I think a lot of the anti-war movement, especially the early days of the anti-war movement, was pushing up against that as much as it was pushing up against the war itself.
Specifically the war in Vietnam.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. And things changed. One of the things that I sometimes bridle against when I talk to some of my students who are much younger than me is that argument that they will sometimes make, some students will make, but it didn't accomplish anything. Civil rights movement didn't accomplish anything. Well, I'm just as a warning, don't ever say that to an older African-American person, because they'll take your head off. And they have every right to. Things changed, but they didn't change as much as activists had hoped and dreamed they would, because there was a reaction to it. That's why I think of this as kind of a partial shattering. Things changed, and then the movements hit brick walls. Some mm-hmm. movements went farther than other movements went. Some of those changes went farther than other movements went. 1960-61, the idea of repealing, not reforming, much less repealing, but repealing abortion laws was not on the political agenda. By 1973, it was a reality.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really dramatic change. Civil rights made dramatic inroads, but it also hit against walls. So that's why I say it's a partial shattering. As to which side weighed in the end won, I like the extra innings analogy, actually, because I think it really does speak to the fact that the issues that were raised then, the issues that pushed their way to the center of American public life, there was civil rights activism long before the 1960s.
Right.
But when it became a defining issue, those are still unsettled. And I think the abortion ruling that's coming down in the next few weeks, presumably, is a perfect example of that. The issues that pushed their way to the center in the 1960s haven't gone anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They've morphed. They've changed. Of course they have. 50 years is an awfully long time. But those issues remain as volatile as they have ever been.
Yeah, I think some of the numbers have shifted as to what's the conventional mainstream and the either the reactionary or the revolutionary. You know, that I think has all changed, but nothing's settled. And I'm going to throw one thing out, which I don't want you to respond to yet, because I want to go to another question. One of the things I think is that a lot of the values, culturally especially, of the 1960s, I think are ascendant in young people today. And if you look at certain things, like the fact that that marijuana is legal in some form, you know, in a great deal of the nation, the strides of LGBTQ, some things like that. But the things to me where movement has been less successful, I find you can usually follow the money. The military-industrial complex, for instance, for all you can talk about it as, whether it's about patriotism or nation building, in every congressional district, it's about jobs. And I think economic justice, why inequality is now worse than it was in the 60s, is again, follow the money. And the one that I have a little more trouble fitting into that pattern is the systemic racism. But I think if you think about the economic value of scapegoating, for instance, perhaps it fits that one as well. Your thoughts?
That is a lot on the table there, Terrence. I agree with you for the most part. I am more hesitant to, in fact, I would...
Go ahead.
Yeah, this is really fun. I agree with you on some of those questions, like the military-industrial complex question. The amount of money and the ways in which that money, what has been since the late 1940s and certainly in the 1950s, integrated into people's lives,
mm-hmm.
the way people's livelihoods depend on that flow of dollars, has made it kind of an institutional power that is, in the end, seems almost unassailable. So I agree with you there. I would push actually the money trail even harder on a few issues. You're absolutely right. It's really another striking transformation in that 50-year period, and really in the last 10 years, about the legalization of marijuana, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
I think that part of that, I'm not saying it's all of that, but part of that is actually about following the money as well. Because what the legalization of marijuana has done is it's opened new tax revenues for cities or municipalities that are cash starved because
mm-hmm.
it's an impossibility in America's political climate to raise, say, property taxes or income taxes.
Right. So where can you find a new form of tax?
Exactly.
That's hard to find.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's part of the reason why we have such a dramatic legalization of gambling in the United States.
Oh, my God, now, you're so right. Oh, let me just jump in one quickly and say I just got a book in the mail, you know, someone proposing do an interview with the authors called Can Legal Weed Win?, which actually asks the question, is it possible for those tax revenues and that market to actually triumph over black market marijuana? And that's a story to be settled later.
Yeah, it's a question for another time. I think where I will, and you kind of pointed to this, so I think where I would push a little harder against the kind of economic argument as definitive is on the white supremacy question. Mm-hmm. I think that that is about expressions of power in so many ways. It is political power. It is personal power. Obviously, it's racial power. It certainly has an economic dimension to it, white supremacy, but is also has a power independent of that, or maybe mm-hmm. transcending that.
Yeah, well,
that's a terrifying thing.
Yeah, I think, by the way, I was saying that I think the outlier is racism. But if I were to look for an economic justification or an economic explanation for its persistence, I would say that it's the value to the wealthy, to the ones who profit off this, of having a scapegoat. And you could even say, and I hadn't even worked this out before, Kevin, but you could say that the capacity of the Republican Party to pass its tax cuts and appoint its justices to for whatever anyone thinks about religion or sex or anything else, the most consistent ideology of the Roberts Court is pro-corporate and against individuals. But so you could say, how has the Republican Party been able to do all of that? And that whole thing about, you know, what's the matter with Kansas and getting people to vote against their self-interest is by tapping into the white supremacy and the racism, so that it's almost a bank shot.
So this, I admit, sounds like a really odd thing to say when we're talking about a subject as grim and as depressing and as terrifying, really, as white supremacy in America today. But I just have to say that I'm actually really enjoying this conversation, because it feels like a real conversation. We're actually talking about important issues, which isn't something that always happens when you're doing an interview. So I just want to thank you for that.
Oh, I really appreciate that, Kevin. Let me return to one previous question that, again, about your writing, and not so much about the content of this book. And that is that your first book, which I haven't read, but I read you talk about it, the one on the labor movement, 48 to 68, was, I think, an academic book. And you say that you gave it to your parents as a gift, and you'd visit, and the bookmark never moved. And you realized that if you wanted to reach larger people with the work you were doing and the ideas that you were hopefully provoking people with, that you had to adapt. You also say that one thing you did was, with Arc of Justice, you sent each chapter to your father, who replied with notes. And I sort of look at that and say your dad's notes helped you win the National Book Award. So talk about that transformation in your approach to your writing.
Sure. That's a great question. So my parents were, and they're both passed on now, but my parents were, they were wonderful people, I have to say. And my father in particular was a huge reader. He loved to read. But my dad didn't go to college. My dad had a high school diploma. When I finished that first book, which was definitely an academic book, it was a revised version of my PhD dissertation, I gave it to my parents, and my parents, being the great people they were, so excited. Oh, you wrote a book. We're thrilled. And as you said, they put it on the shelf in the living room, and I'd come home for the next 20 years, and there would be that bookmark where they gave up. And that's not a criticism of them. It's a criticism of the way that I had written it. I wrote it in that kind of academic idiom that basically says to other academics, here's how you can get through this book without really reading it. And says to non-academics, you don't want to read it. And that struck me as a really weird combination once I thought about it. Why are you, as a writer, writing in a way that makes your two target audiences not want to read it? And so I said to myself, I want to write a book that my dad would want to read. And so when I turned to Arc of Justice, which is a story about civil rights in the 1920s, I tried to write it in a way that I knew that I hoped, is a better way of putting it, that someone like my dad would want to read. And so it had a strong storyline. It had strong characters. So again, I tried to make as honestly as I could the historical record would allow me to do. But it didn't use words that were going to get in the way. And it didn't say things like, as historian X or Y says, because when an ordinary person reads that, a non-academic person reads that, what they say is, I don't know who person X is.
Yeah.
Why is he in the book?
Yeah.
Or if it makes them feel bad, I guess I'm supposed to know who person X is, but I don't. So it doesn't do all those things. I tried to write it in a way that people would find gripping. And to do that, to see if I was on track, I would, like you said, every time I finished a chapter, I would send my dad a chapter. My dad was such a nice person, and he so was more concerned about my mental health than he was about the book, that he would always write back and say, this is great.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, no matter how bad it was, which is nice. I had other people who could say to me, no, that's not great. And you got to work on that. And when the book came out, he read it. And that's one of my, you know, this sounds like an odd thing to say, but it's one of my proudest accomplishments. My dad read it.
I thoroughly understand. I thoroughly understand. And he has passed since now, so he didn't get to read the chapters of this one. Well, let me just share one little incident from my own life, which is my wife, who had a successful career as a sitcom writer, afterwards applied to the master's program at Penn in positive psychology, which is pretty much the birthplace, Martin Seligman and so on. We'd think that's a pretty, you know, radical, progressive sort of program. And she said, I want to learn your content so that I can bring it to popular audiences. And on her first paper, she got a note that said, you've been marked down because you used personal experience and metaphor.
Yeah.
And that was a moment where she knew she might not make it through the whole program. and she didn't. She quit after a semester. But the notion that personal experience and metaphor are verboten in an academic paper is just, you know, it tells you all you need to know.
Yeah.
Okay.
While it is okay to use the passive voice all the time.
Oh, my God, yes. Oh, my God, yes. Okay. This is Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm talking with Kevin Boyle. I'm Terrence McNally. And Kevin won the National Book Award for his previous book, Arc of Justice. He's a professor of American history at Northwestern University. We're talking about his latest book, The Shattering, America in the 1960s. And you can learn more at kevinboylehistory.com. That's Kevin Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E, history, all one word, .com. One of the things that most struck me, we're jumping into content here in a big way, about your analysis, and I've, as you can sort of tell, have thought a lot about the 60s. But I sort of went, wow, I hadn't quite looked at it that way. Is your focus on millions of Americans' hunger for an embrace of security? Yeah. After living through, as you mentioned when you're doing the biography of Cahill, is that they lived through the influenza pandemic, which was much worse even than the COVID. They lived through the Depression, World War II, and they were living now in the face of the nuclear threats of the Cold War. Security was all, that middle-class security, and that's what was threatened. One thing I would say, that's what created, in a way, the possibility of these young people having the time and the energy and the freedom to make revolutionary demands of the system, but it's also what made those challenges to the system so threatening. Talk a bit about that, because I think it is really at the core of your book.
It is at the core of my book. And I really appreciate you pointing that out, because one of the things that came to me teaching about the 1960s is that the story of the 60s is often told from a young person's perspective. Mm-hmm. And that's fair enough, because young people played critical roles in so many of the key movements of the 1960s. But of course, most Americans in the 1960s weren't young. So all you have to do is do the math. If you were 40 years old in 1960, that means you were born in 1920. And that means that your life was marked by some of the greatest instability in the American experience. That means you lived through the utter collapse of the American economy, because that's what the Great Depression was. It wasn't a bad downturn. It was the utter collapse of the American industrial economy for a decade. You lived through the most horrific war as a young adult. You lived through the most horrific war human beings had ever waged against each other. 60 million people died in World War II. You lived with a world that seemed fundamentally unsafe and insecure. And if you were, as the Cahills, the family I start and end the book with, if you were folks like the Cahills, working class people, then that instability was greater still. And so this desire for intense hunger for security really helped to define the life that folks like the Cahills and millions of other people built for themselves. That was a driving force, and it's an understandable one. You can see why someone who, like Stella Cahill, who is the wife of the couple that I'm following, so desperately wanted for herself. But here's the tricky thing. The security that they built for themselves in the 1950s in particular, late 40s and 1950s, a decade and a half after World War II, it rested on racial exclusion. That home that the Cahills owned out in the far west side of Chicago was in a neighborhood segregated by practice and by government policy in protection of a security that was a racialized security. Ed Cahill, Stella's husband, he worked for a little manufacturing company in Chicago no one ever heard of. I am the only person ever to write a history book that mentions the vacuum can company Chicago. But it was a military supplier. Now, not of anything major. They supplied coffee urns to the military. It was tied to the military industrial complex. His security, that family's security, his paycheck, had a tie to that military industrial complex. And they lived in an intensely parochial world. A world built around, in their case, the Catholic parish and the Catholic church. And that's what starts to get cracked open. That's racial exclusions on housing. Those the attacks on the military-industrial complex, the transformations that come through people pushing against that parochial world that they lived in. So that the sense of security is real, it's important, and we should acknowledge that as historians looking at the past. We could see why they would want something like that, but we also need to see the ways in which that security intersected with these injustices or exclusions or systems of oppression that they didn't see.
That's right. I was just going to say that were blind spots to many, not to George Wallace, perhaps, but to many, they were blind spots.
George Wallace's genius, if you could call it that, was that he understood how fragile a world that was for so many people and how desperately they wanted to hold on to it and how it was infused with race.
And he understood that it wasn't just in the South.
Oh, yeah. That's the thing. That it was so easy. To this day, it's so easy for those of us who are Northerners, white Northerners, which I am, to say, oh, race, that's a problem those people have down there. And historians have done a very good job in the last 20 years or so saying, oh, no. That the racial problems of the United States, the racial dynamics of the United States are national dynamics. But I think for an awful lot of Americans who aren't in academic discussions, those folks we were talking about a couple minutes ago, they still don't think of it that way. I think it's changing, but slowly. Northern Americans still have that great comfort of saying, well, okay, we have some problems, but it's not like those people in the South. Those people, they have racial issues. That's one of the things I wanted to explode.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why starting that book out in that neighborhood in Chicago was important to me.
You trace the roots of today's polarizations and animosities to the 60s,
yep.
and then to their roots in earlier decades. But I often think that they're traceable to at least the Civil War, if not the founding.
Oh, yeah. I agree with you on that. But man, you think it would be a long book then. I agree that especially the question of race, but also the question of America's place in the world, all of these issues. Really,
and also just in some ways, a north-south, a rural-urban, you know, all that stuff that plays out in Goldwater, in Nixon, in Wallace, and then in Trump.
Yeah, it's true that none of these dynamics come out of, they all have very, very deep roots in the United States. But I think the particular form of it, maybe because of the ways in which that promise of security actually did consolidate for a while.
Yes.
That's what's really different, that Americans, especially poorer Americans, working class Americans, throughout the American experience, lived lives of stunning insecurity. You know, where you're one accident, where you're one illness away from catastrophe. And that finally...
For a while,
we are back to that before it turned out to be a very brief period. Not for everyone, God knows, but for millions of Americans, particularly millions of white working class Americans, for what turned out to be a really brief period, they broke that cycle.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what they were desperate to hold on to.
Yeah, I've said it and you've sort of resonated to it, but that to remember to look at what the larger context was. One of the things that I haven't really figured out what I think about all of this, but that Nixon would talk about a silent majority,
and
was probably accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Was probably accurate.
Yeah.
That it probably was a majority. To the current moment, when we are suffering minority rule.
Yeah.
That a lot of the values, this goes back to something I sort of began to say earlier, a lot of the values of the 60s have weathered pretty well. And Americans as a majority now, I think, hold a lot of those values. Back then, it was a minority fighting for change. Now it's a minority fighting to rule despite change.
Yeah. I think that's a really nice way of putting it. It's in some ways, what we have now in American public life is that minority that you're talking about trying to hold back the dam. So many fundamental perspectives have changed. And the American people have changed.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I think is so important to keep in mind is, and I mentioned this at the start of the book, that America, the United States, was never more homogenous in the 20th century than it was in 1960. Lowest percentage of immigrants in the 20th century American experience was 1960.
And for people who don't understand, well, why would that be? It would be that we had actually changed our immigration laws during the 20th century and had reduced immigration. And that is what resulted in that moment being the peak of homogenization.
Yeah, exactly.
We were 85% white. We're now 60% white.
Yes. The Asian American population in 1960 in the United States was 0.3% of the population. So it wasn't even a half of 1% of the population was Asian American, because those laws had excluded Asian American immigration. So it was a fundamentally different world. The nation than the one that we're living in now. And then when you talk about attitudinal changes, LGBTQ rights, unimaginable in the early 1960s, the blatant discrimination, gender discrimination, the blatant racial, I mean, Jim Crow was still in complete operation in 1960.
I grew up in the South, in Florida.
That's right.
And whether people consider it the South or not, both of my high schools, I went to one high school in Jacksonville, 9th and 10th grade, and another high school in Cocoa, 11th and 12th. Both were integrated for the first time while I was there. And both times it was 8 African Americans in a population, the first school of about 1,500, the second school of about 2,500.
Wow.
And I lived at a time when I certainly saw colored only water fountains, colored only restrooms, all of that. I think young people now, that's ancient history. I want to jump to one silly thing just because it made me laugh, and then kind of go on to sort of our last kind of conclusions. When you're laying this picture of that America wasn't a bubbling cauldron of change, you remind us of the enormous popularity of nostalgic culture in the 60s. And I just jumped on that, perhaps it's because I'm from the entertainment industry, but in 1966, The Sound of Music, about as mainstream as you could get, became the highest grossing film of all time. And for anyone who's curious, what it replaced was Gone with the Wind. So it's kind of interesting when you look at that. And that no less a classic than The Love Bug was the second highest grossing film of 1969.
Yeah.
That made me Kevin, go back and look at what were the top 10 in 1969, and I think nothing shows America's schizophrenia better. The top 10 grossing films in 1969 included, on the one hand, Midnight Cowboy, Easy Rider, and Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, right? Which is, you know, that's the cutting edge, that's the revolution. On the other hand, the top 10 also included The Love Bug, Paint Your Wagon, and True Grit, starring John Wayne.
Yes.
And as you say, you managed...
And Glenn Campbell, I'll just add.
Yes, yes, yes. you have said you managed to write a history of the 60s without once mentioning Bob Dylan, yet you do mention Bobby Vinton.
So yes, I do.
That's my little detour into pop culture.
I can't tell you how much I appreciate that, because I'm kind of proud of my line about The Sound of Music.
Absolutely. I mean, and that's the kind of thing that, oh my, that's a wake-up call to people. I didn't realize that. When we're talking about Wallace to Nixon to Trump. Mm-hmm. Trump ends up depending in 2016 on the Midwest's middle class, but it struck me who he defeated. He defeated the first female candidate of a major party who, in her 1969 Wellesley commencement address, called for an end to the Vietnam War. I mean, if there was a perfect opponent for that silent majority existing in 2016 to assert itself, it was in that competition.
Yeah, that's such a terrific point, because it's an encapsulation of this world that both of those people came out of. That,
yes.
You know, Trump is a product of a military academy high
that's
school,
right.
Which he graduated from in, I don't know what year, but like 63, 64, something like that. You know, so they're both products of that world. I will toss in, just as a tiny aside, that Hillary Clinton is also from the suburbs, the west side
That's
suburbs
right.
of Chicago.
That's right.
Not very far, actually, from the Cahills, though, a suburban area rather than in the city.
The Rodhams, yes, yes.
Yes, exactly.
Now, when you get to the end of the book, you point out that the Cahills, and we've talked about them, but we haven't even said that the photo that you jump from is a photo where Ed Cahill has put up flags all through his neighborhood and celebrates the American flag on July 4th and so on.
Yeah.
But that they end up voting for George McGovern in 1972.
Yeah.
Now, one point I want to make that people may not be aware of, although you are, in 1968, 62% of whites voted for either Nixon or Wallace.
Yeah.
In 1972, Nixon took 70% of the white vote. But what people may not realize is that no Democratic presidential candidate has won a majority of white voters since 1964.
Well, in fact, 64 is anomalous. Lyndon Johnson is the only Democrat to win a majority of the white vote. Before him, the last time that had happened was 1948. So actually, from 1952 to the present, only once has a Democratic Party candidate, Lyndon Johnson, won a majority of the white vote.
And if you think about it,
1952.
It follows a presidential assassination and the nomination of Goldwater, but I think a presidential assassination in which the country is voting on emotions they don't normally feel.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that Lyndon Johnson exploited beautifully.
Yes.
I mean, you know,
yes.
He was a brilliant politician in his day.
When we've got about just a couple of minutes, what's the kind of last word, or sort of the questions you're asking yourself now, having put this book to bed, or the next question for listeners based on this conversation?
I think what I would love people to take away from this book, and I hope that people will take a look at it, is the complexity of the past. Yes, we tell stories in order to live, but we don't want to tell simple stories. What you want to tell is a story of the past that captures some sense of its complexity. And sometimes history moves in powerfully inspirational ways. And sometimes it moves in really deeply tragic ways. And sometimes it does both of those at the same time. And it seems to me that at its essence, that's the story of the 1960s, that complexity of enormous possibility and profound tragedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you very much. So again, the book is The Shattering, America in the 1960s. You can learn more at kevinboylehistory.com. Kevin Boyle, B-O-Y-L-E, history, all one word, .com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally, all one word, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 10 articles that will flesh out the conversation, email me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform Podcast on most of those podcast sites and at my site. You can find years of podcasts at those sites and mine. Listen anytime, anywhere. Michael Lewis, Naomi Klein, Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, George Packard. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production, George Vassilopoulos of Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Kevin Boyle, and keep up your good work.
Thank you so much for having me, Terrence.
Hi, it's radio veteran Nicole Sandler. Sadly, the radio we all grew up listening to no longer exists. The industry in which I worked for 40 years has been decimated.
I turned up the radio. I can't hear it.
Thanks to the Telecommunications Act of 1996, a handful of giant corporations control what you hear on the so-called public airwaves all across the nation.
So you better listen to the right side of reason. But they don't give you any choice because they think that it's treason. So you had better do what you were told. You better listen to the radio.
But times have changed.
Turn it up! Turn it up!
It's the 21st century, and at Progressive Voices, we're reclaiming our time. Radio, your way. Progressive Voices, Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, Randy Rhodes, Nicole Sandler, Brad Friedman, Mike Malloy, and many more. Download the free Progressive Voices app, now powered by TuneIn. Speaking truth to power, 24/7 on the Progressive Voices Network.
Progressive Voices desperately needs your financial help. Please go to progressivevoices.com and press the donate button right now. Thank you.
Hi, this is Randy Rhodes right here on the Progressive Voices Network.
The Randy Rhodes Show. Smart, forward, free thinking, entertaining, bringing you liberal news and opinion that challenges the status quo and amplifies free speech. Every weekday afternoon, 3 to 5 Eastern.
Hi, it's Randy Rhodes. Listen to me on the PV live stream or on demand or both on the PV app. Just go to progressivevoices.com or download the Progressive Voices app.
If you want 24/7 access to everything progressive on the mobile internet, download the Progressive Voices app at progressivevoices.com. The PV app is a one-stop shop that aggregates everything progressive: news, blogs, audio, video, opinion, then thoughtfully curates, prioritizes, and presents the progressive content. The purpose is to create a progressive media universe, an alternative to the one controlled by cable operators, radio station owners, and newspaper publishers. That's the PV app at progressivevoices.com.
Thanks for listening to the Progressive Voices Network, streaming the best in progressive talk 24/7. Keep the progressive conversation going on by joining our community. Each week, we send out an email that covers important things taking place in the Progressive Voices Network and throughout the progressive world. Be the first to know of upcoming shows, schedule changes, exclusive programming, and more. Simply go to progressivevoices.com and sign up for our mailing list. It's that easy. Progressivevoices.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining the Progressive Voices community.
Hey, it's Stephanie Miller. Here's what we're talking about.
He tried to personally deliver fake electors, yeah. And now he's trying to, like, throw a staffer under the bus.
Ron Johnson, he said he didn't even know what was in the envelope.
Sure.
He was going to hand-deliver something
like
that he didn't know what was in the envelope.
At the airport, hand you something and say, here, could you take this package of what is not at all drugs on this flight with you? And you automatically say, absolutely, well, I would do that.
Find the Stephanie Miller Show every Monday through Friday at 9 to noon Eastern, 6 to 9 Pacific, right here on Progressive Voices.
I'm Desi Doyen from BradBlog.com.
And I'm Brad Friedman, also from BradBlog.com.
You're listening to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
CD quality audio, fewer commercials.
And all your favorite progressive shows.
Like Hartman, Miller, Malloy.
And more.
And instead of local commercials, you hear great features.
Like the Brad Blog's Green News Report.
That is great. No local radio affiliate, no prob. We're mobile.
We are where you are.
So while you're visiting BradBlog.com,
don't forget to listen to Progressive Voices.
And don't forget to spread the word.
Thanks for listening to the Progressive Voices Network, streaming the best in progressive talk 24/7. Keep the progressive conversation going on by joining our community. Each week, we send out an email that covers important things taking place in the Progressive Voices Network and throughout the progressive world. Be the first to know of upcoming shows, schedule changes, exclusive programming, and more. Simply go to progressivevoices.com and sign up for our mailing list. It's that easy. Progressivevoices.com. Thanks for listening, and thanks for joining the Progressive Voices community.